in your Bibles to Malachi chapter 2. Question 8 on page 42, and then Malachi chapter 2. This is a quick run-through of the prophecy of Malachi. We're not doing a verse-by-verse study. We're just trying to fit this into the study of Ezra and Nehemiah. Here's what we finished with on Wednesday night, making some application. This was question 7. And this was sort of there toward the middle part of chapter 1. How God felt about their worship, and how we can commit the same sin today, even though our worship is different than what the remnant was offering. The principle is obviously the same. I hope that you can see that. If we're not giving our best, then we can come in here, if you said Wednesday night, sit in the pew every time, sing and pray and eat the supper. But if our heart's not in it, if we're not fully engaged in the worship, then we'll get the very same sin that the remnant was guilty of. And these passages here in the New Testament, remember Jesus talked about worshiping God in spirit and in truth, John chapter 4, to the Samaritan woman, what Paul preached on Mars Hill, how that God wants man to seek Him. He wants man to find Him. And man's got to have that desire to commune with his God and to just come to worship, or rather, with a cavalier attitude, that's not acceptable. And God didn't like it then, and of course He won't like it today. So that's where we ended up with class on Wednesday night. All right. Let's look now at chapter 2, verses 1 through 9. This is another strong text with respect to God giving or dispensing a judgment to the priests. Again, you see there in chapter 2, verse 1, "And now this commandment is for you, O priests." So again, he's specifying, all the remnant is guilty of some things that's being addressed, but you start at the top, you start with the leaders when there's a problem, and he's addressing the priests here in this section. So the first part of verse 2, he says that if you do not listen, and if you do not take it to heart to give honor to my name, then you see there the punishment in verse 2, which was what? What was God going to do? I'll send something on you. A curse rather than a blessing. Remember those ancient assemblies where they would gather on the two mountains, Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. And on one mountain was the blessings, and on the mountain was the cursings. Blessings if they did what? Yeah, if you did right, if you did what the Lord commanded. But if you don't do what the Lord said, then the priest would utter the curses, and that would be just or fit punishment. So maybe that's what he's referring to. If they did not listen or take to heart the Lord's word, and of course, if the priests don't take it to heart, then who else won't? The people, because the people's job is to teach, or the priest's job is to teach the people. And if the priests aren't fully engaged in this, then why would they expect the remnant to do any better? And again, you see the parallel. What if elders of a local church won't do what's right? Then why would the sheep who are following be expected to do any better than what the leadership did, obviously? What if a man who's leading his home won't do right? Then why should the wife or the children, if there are children, why should she or they do any better than he's doing? So you start with the leadership. The last part of verse 2 through verse 3, there are some things that he says, and I want you to look at these real quickly. He said, first off, he said, blessings will become curses. And again, and we'll just cite these verses this morning just for sake of time. But you'll see in passages like number 6, it was the priests, one of their functions was to bless the people, pronounce blessings upon them. And of course, again, that would be for their obedience. But if they wouldn't do right, then all the blessings they would pronounce would become nothing. God says, I'll turn your blessings into a curse if you will not follow me and take to heart what my word teaches. So that's in there in verse 2. Also he said, and this may be a confusing verse, first part of verse 3, behold, I'm going to rebuke your offspring, my version says. Now the King James says what? Your seed? Your corrupt your seed. Some versions say, I will corrupt your arm. That's the literal reading. So some women say, all right, what's if we take the idea that if you don't do right, then I'm going to corrupt your offspring, your seed, your offspring. That gives the indication that God's going to punish future generations for the failure of this one. Is there a problem with that from the Scripture? That's right. God doesn't respect persons, but what had He told the prophet Ezekiel? The son shall not bear the guilt of the father. The soul that sins, it shall die. Would it be right for God to rebuke the future generation for the failures of the fathers? That's not how God operates. The soul that sins dies. So the idea seems to be this literal reading, this translation of the word arm. Some writers say that this would be referring to their arm or their ability to officiate at the altar, their own service, their own work of offering and administering sacrifices. Again, if they don't take to heart what the Lord was saying in His Word, then what about their work at the altar? It wouldn't be valid at all. It would become corrupted. And again, what if we don't take to heart the Lord's Word? But we come here and we sing just as pretty as a bird in our hymns. God's not impressed with them. Yeah, it's vain worship. God won't receive them. And so I think that may be the heart of what these statements are getting to, if they continued on the way that they were headed. Then He says, I will cover your faces with refuse, or dung, some versions say. What the Scripture says in Exodus 29, when the Israelites would bring their sacrifices to the altar, you had to cut, slit the animal's throat, bleed it out. And then depending on the altar, some were offered up in whole burnt offerings, and then some they had to cut out the entrails or cut out the internal organs, and you had to do something with the carcass and with the refuse or the dung. Well, that verse says do what? Take it outside the camp and you burn it. It would be unclean. Now this is a rather graphic statement. God said, if you don't straighten up, if you don't take to heart my words, then I'll take the dung from that animal and I'll spread it on your face. And what would that do to the priest? It would make them defiled or unclean. That's right. So again, God is saying, to me, you are as defiled, you are as unclean when you don't take to heart my words and teach them and live them appropriately as if you had dung from sacrifices or refuse spread on your face. Now, is that a pretty serious description to you? That's pretty graphic. That's how God felt about it. Yes, absolutely. 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 I mean, this is tremendous defilement. It's like to an extreme. That's how God viewed it. So these statements give us the idea of how serious God was taking their activity as worship leaders, and as teachers, and as those who would set the right example before the remnant. Now, that's what he said, sort of the preliminary warning. Now look at verses 4 through 7. And he talks about a covenant that he made with Levi. He brings that up, doesn't he? He says, then you will know that I have sent this commandment to you, that my covenant may continue with Levi. My covenant with him was one of life and peace. So he's going back when the priesthood started. And we know what tribe provided the priest. Well, he had to be from the tribe of Levi. And from the tribe of Levi, from what family? Family of Aaron. That'd be from Aaron's family. So this covenant he's talking about in these next three verses, look at the statements that he says describing or emphasizing this covenant. It was a covenant of life and peace. And to Levi, it was an object of reverence. Notice he says, and you'll see this as you go through the text, he revered me, he was in awe, he honored my name. What was in his mouth, he said? True instruction. That's there in the start of verse 6. What wasn't found on his lips? Iniquity or unrighteousness, he says, was not found on his lips. He describes him also in the middle of verse 6. He walked with me in peace and uprightness. And what did he do at the end of verse 6? That's right. He turned many back from iniquity. That would be obviously through his what? Through his teaching. That's right. Through his influence on others. He would help them turn away from sin. His lips preserved knowledge, the text says. And men sought instruction from his lips. And then to sort of summarize it at the end of verse 7, he says he was the messenger of the Lord of hosts. Now God says, that's what I had in mind for this tribe when I devised and implemented this priestly function, this priestly system. That's the covenant that I had with him. All right. Now that's the ideal. That's the goal. Now look in, this gets us to top of page 43. This is verses 8 through 9. Verse 8 begins how? But as for you, so here's what I wanted from Levi. Now he makes it personal to the remnant. But as for you, this is what I'm getting from you. Now let's see if it matches the covenant. Does it match the covenant? It doesn't match the covenant. What was he getting from the remnant priests? Things like what? He says, you turned aside from the way. See that? They're in verse 8. What else have they done? You caused many to stumble. That's exactly opposite of what he said that I've demanded of Levi. He helped many turn away from iniquity. You're causing them to stumble. What did Jesus say in the New Testament about causing a little one to stumble? It'd be better for you than what? Hang a millstone around your neck and you'd be dropped from the depth of the sea. God takes it seriously. It's bad enough if we sin. No soul should sin, obviously, and be lost. But if we, through our teaching, our influence, cause someone else to sin, God takes that pretty seriously. And here he says, you've caused many to stumble because of what you're teaching. And he says, you've corrupted the covenant with Levi. You're just not living up to the ideals that I had in mind when I made that covenant. And also he says there in verse 9, that you showed partiality with your instruction. They'd say one thing to one group, maybe being partial to them, but then saying something else to someone else. How must the truth of God be preached? Across the board, impartially. The old phrase, let the chips fall where they may. You teach the truth, now let's be kind, let's be tactful. Obviously. But we've got to be forceful sometimes. Truth's got to get taught. And remember one time the disciples, this is in Matthew 15, I believe, they came to Jesus and said, Master, knowest thou not that thou offended the Pharisees? What did Jesus say? Let them alone. They be blind leaders of the blind, and if the blind lead the blind, they're going to both head for the ditch. So they said, basically, Lord, you really hurt their feelings by what you said. The Lord said, that's just too bad. Their heart's not in it anyway. So we see the Bible certainly does talk about that. Now I've asked the question here in the last part of question 10. Are there kingdom priests today? Does God have His priests today? Who are they? It's us. Who's the high priest? Christ. The book of Hebrews states that clearly. Christ is the high priest. So we are priests today. Well, who's responsible for teaching God's word today? The priests. So can you not see easy application can be made with what he told the remnant priest? Now here's the covenant that I made with Levi. Here's what my expectations were. And he did them. He lived up to those ideas. But here's what you're doing. All right, we can go through it'd be a great study to do that. Go through the New Testament and find expectations God has for his priests today regarding worship, offering worship, regarding teaching, regarding influencing other people for good by right example, all those things. We could find passages that speak to us, and then you see the application. We have to do the same kind of work today that God expected of them. Now, if we do good and keep ourselves faithful and influence other people, then will we have blessings or curses? We'll have blessings, obviously. But what if we don't live up to that expectation? Same thing he told them. There's going to be some problems. And God will be sorely disappointed with us. So it's not hard, I think, for us to see that great application of what this was talking about. So how we live ourselves and influence others directly affects how we stand before God, just like he told them. Same principle. Okay. Now, let's look at... this would be question 11. Verses 10 through 11. We've got 10 through 16 together, but this now seems to be a judgment pronounced by the prophet on their intermarriages. And when we say intermarriage, we are referring to what? Usually. Well, I shouldn't say usually. Always. Yes, they were marrying the pagans around them. Have we seen this addressed before? We have. And by the fact that Malachi brings it up again, indicates what? They're having a hard time leaving this alone. They will not stop it. And so God has to bring it up again. So look in verse 11. And I think we see God's main concern. Now, again, we've looked at when we read Ezra chapters 9 and 10 at the start of earlier in this quarter. That's when Ezra brought it up. And we notice there, and we'll show it again on the charts, Deuteronomy 7 is the passage in the law that forbid them from doing this. And as Moses said back there in Deuteronomy 7, and now here in verse 11, it wasn't just the fact that God said, okay, those people aren't like you. I don't want you marrying them. That's not what his concern was. Verse 11, how does Malachi refer to the foreign woman in verse 11? Now, say that again, Mary. She's the daughter of a strange god. What's that emphasizing? Yeah, idolatry. It's not the fact that she's just a foreigner. She's not a Hebrew. You can't marry someone who's not a Hebrew. It's how God said it. She's the daughter of a pagan or a foreign god. And that tells us right there God's concern is idolatry. That's why I'm forbidding these marriages. Again, as Ezra said it, and as Moses said it back in that text in Deuteronomy 7, they'll take your heart away from me, and they'll lead you to unfaithfulness. And yes. Yes. Don't make covenants with them. Don't enter into agreements with them. When you go inside the land to take it, Israel had one job to do, which was what? Destroy them. Kill them. Annihilate them. Wipe them out. He says, don't leave any of them around. If you leave them around, they'll become what in your sides? Thorns in your sides. They'll haunt you, and they'll trouble you, and they'll pester you all your days if you don't do what I'm telling you to do. And can there be any more intimate relationship among humans than marriage? There's not. Those of us who are married, we know exactly how strong marriage is. One spouse says, well, I want to do this, and if you don't want to do it, but you want to please one another. And that's the concern. And so here you go, you marry this foreign woman, and she's got her God, and she's known this God all her life. Doesn't want to leave him. What was it that turned Solomon's heart away? That very thing. So much so that in Jerusalem, what did he build? He built temples for their gods, and if that wasn't bad enough, what else did he do? He went in those temples and worshiped with his foreign wives. And it had to be such a great disappointment to God that he did that, because he married them. So God's concern here is idolatry. He says in these verses, it profaned the covenant. Exodus 34:16 said, don't do it. Deuteronomy 7, 1 through 5 said, don't do it. And to do it, blatant disobedience, was profane. Here's this holy covenant, this spiritual agreement, and they're just walking all over, trampling, going ahead and doing it anyway. God says it was treacherous and an abomination. So when you read at least through verse 11 of chapter 2 of Malachi, I don't have any trouble. I don't think anybody does. And the auditor has no trouble seeing what God thought about this behavior. Unacceptable, totally. And shouldn't have happened to begin with. Okay. Now, again, it ought to have been addressed. That's Ezra chapters 9 and 10. Look also at verse 12. As for the one who does this, the one who's going to go ahead and marry these pagans anyway, what the prophet say? You're going to be cut off. When you see that in the Scripture, particularly you'll see it in the Old Testament, somebody from Israel is going to be cut off. What's that talking about? All right, yes. But I'm not sure it means literally cut down as, like, you know, executed. Okay, that's true. Yes, you'll be removed from the assembly. I'm going to cut you off. If you want to use the word excommunication, I think that'd be a proper way to think about that. Now, what Freddie says also, if they committed sins that were of a capital offense, they would literally be cut down, and then their seed would be cut off, because that family would be removed from the, you know, from the genealogy. But this phrase, generally speaking, you'll be cut off from Israel, means you'll be kicked out. We have a similar condition in the New Testament? We do, don't we? When someone endures in sin, what is the church told to do? We've got to withdraw from them. Isn't that a cutting off? Being cut out, that's what that is. So the concept is the same. The concept is the same. God cannot tolerate those who persist in sin and yet want to maintain their ties to the group. That's not allowed. God doesn't go for them. So the guilty is going to be cut off, he says. Now, here's the expressive part of the text, verses 13 and 14. This is another thing you do, the prophet said. What was being done? You cover the altar with what? Tears. The altar was covered with tears. Now, I've asked the question, whose tears do you think this was? It doesn't say, but if you read the text and consider what it's talking about, I think it's, yeah, the old wives. The old women. No, the ones who had been put away. I know what you mean. I'm just picking at you. The ones who had been put away so that the men then could do what? Marry the pagans. So here were men that were married, Hebrew wives, and they see somebody out here they like better, and they just would put this wife away and then go marry the pagan. And what was that doing? How was that treating the what we'll call her the lawful wife? How was that treating her? Absolutely. Treacherously. Showing great contempt. That's right. The wife of his youth. Now, when you see this phrase, the wife of your youth, I think that typically means this isn't a young couple. This was someone who'd been married for a while. Were they old people? I don't think we can say that, but it wasn't like newlyweds. She's been your wife for a while. She's been your wife from youth. She's also your companion by covenant. You see that phrase also. So with God referring to it that way, what does that tell us how God views marriage? This is a covenant. This is a covenant that can't just be cast aside lightly. Now, those of you who are married, when you got married, did you exchange vows of some sort, some fashion, one way or another? I know there's different ways to do it, but basically, didn't we exchange vows? What's a vow? That's a covenant. That's a promise. Well, basically, what did you promise? I know we may have phrased our vows differently, but basically, what are you promising? I'm going to be faithful to you for how long? All my life. I'm not going to leave you. I'm going to forsake all of us. I won't have a wandering eye, roaming feet. I won't have any of that. I'm going to be true to you. And I think that when I say marriages, this is what I say, and it needs to be emphasized. You're not just promising this person. Who else are you promising? I'm promising God. I'm going to be true to you. But what had happened here? They broke their promise. They walked away from that covenant. What's the problem? The scourge of divorce among Christians? When I talk about the world, I mean Christians who walk away from marriage. What's the problem? They're walking away from their promise. Going to the bed of adultery. And that's just not right. There's just no good in that at all. Yeah? Well, maybe so. Freddie's point is, could the tears on the altar be the men's tears who'd be having to leave these foreign wives. That certainly is possible. But to me, if you consider all these verses together, at least down through verse 16, this is a rebuke. This is a strong rebuke. And it seems to me what's being talked about is that how you've treated with contempt, and it's an abomination how you treated your wives. And again, I know it doesn't say it's their tears, but that's what I'm led to think. It's their tears. And you're being rebuked for putting her away unlawfully. That's at least how I view it. So most likely, it is the tears of the put away wives. And God said this was a treacherous way. There's the two important statements. She is the wife of your youth, that's in verse 14, against whom you have dealt treacherously, as though she is your companion and your wife by covenant. Now, this is as strong a passage as any, Old or New Testament, to me, Malachi chapter 2, that tells us of the permanence of marriage. This is a strong one. And verse 16, often quoted, first part of verse 16. What was God's feeling about it? I hate it. I'm just opposed to it. Look also there in the end of verse 13. What else was happening because of these divorces? Yeah, God said, I'm not going to accept your sacrifices, your offer. Why is that? Because of this. So, in this context, marital unfaithfulness, or the unlawful putting away of these lawful wives, would result in, God says, I'm not going to receive your worship anymore. Maybe that's why they cried. I don't know. Maybe that's possible too. But I thought of 1 Peter 3 and verse 7, a passage spoken to husbands. Husbands, live with your wives, or dwell with your wives with understanding, and treat her as the fellow heir of the grace of life, so that what? Your prayers be not hindered. Is that a form of worship when you pray to your father? So husbands, what if you don't treat your wife the way you ought to? What are you doing? You're cutting off your... What access do you have to God? Well, I can think of two. We can talk to Him. We can pray to Him. And then we can hear Him. How do we hear Him? Through His Word, when we study His Word. But how else can you talk to God except through prayer? That's your only channel of communication to Him, is through prayer. And if you're a husband and you treat your wife with contempt, what's Peter say you're doing? God won't hear your prayers. So your worship will be hindered. Same principle here. Very same principle. It's just that important. It's just that serious. We need to see that. Okay. So again, he says in verse 15, and this is a differently translated verse 2. My verse 15 says, but not one who has done so, who has a remnant of the Spirit. And that seems to me to indicate those who are trying to live by the teachings of the Spirit, they won't act this way. Now, I know the King James reads differently. How does the King James read? Well, I'll read the New King James, just the first part of verse 15. Yes. Okay, now that reading is indicating that God made them one together. That would, of course, have been the lawful marriage. God didn't join the Hebrew and the pagan together. That was an unlawful marriage. You talk about the one that you put away unlawfully. He made them one, and you've dealt with that treacherously. So both translations teach an important principle. But I'm going to go off the American standard here that says one who walks by the Spirit, by the teachings of God, he won't act this way. He won't do this because he tries to honor the promise that he made when he promised his wife, I'm going to be true to you. And so again, he says at the end of verse 15, take heed then to your spirit and let no one deal treacherously against the wife of your youth. Be true to your promise. Again, verse 15, God hates it. He hates the unlawful putting away. And he fully expects couples to marry, or who marry, to stay together. Now, I know this verse doesn't apply to us. It's not our covenant. It was spoken to the Hebrews. But it's written for our learning. And so if you're contemplating getting married, you turn to Malachi 2 and you read verse 10 to 16. What's the main thing you come away with there? It's for life. What if you're already married and you read this passage? It reminds you of what? I made a promise. I gave my word. Are there some rough spots in marriage? Well, obviously. Two people getting along who were raised differently and have their own opinions, and that's all got to be melded together. But it can work. It's a beautiful relationship. But the thing you can't ever do is quit. You can't walk away from that promise. Yes, absolutely. Pharisees were, yes, that's right. Matthew 19, is it lawful to divorce your wife for any cause at all? Different Pharisees taught different things. Different rabbis taught different things. And Jesus, where did he point them back to? From the beginning, it was not so. He goes right back to before the gospel, even before the law. From creation, when God instituted marriage. That's a good point to make, brother. Okay. Now, just sort of lumping some things together, here are some other judgments that he seems to make. And again, keep in mind the style of Malachi, as we said on Wednesday night. The charge is made. It's objected to. Well, what do you mean? That's what we're guilty of. And then the proof is given. Verse 17 is another one. What's the charge in verse 17 of Malachi 2? The prophet says what? You've done what? You've wearied the Lord with your words. They said what? How have we done that? So where's the proof of that? And how have they done it? The prophet gives the proof. What was the proof? What words were they saying that was wearying the Lord? That's right. What? Everyone who does evil seems to get away with it. Now, what is that doing to God? See, it's wearying to Him. That's what the prophet says. Why was it wearying God? It's questioning His control of the moral universe. If everyone, you know, all things being equal, if you do evil, what should you expect? Punishment. But they were saying, as we see things, you do evil, you get ahead, you get by with it. And if you do good, you get left behind. That just seems backwards. That doesn't seem like the way it ought to work. So they were questioning His moral rule. Evil was seen as good. And they were not being punished. The last phrase of verse 17. Where is the God of what? Yeah, where's the justice? There's no justice anymore. They might as well come out and say, I thought God was in control of all this stuff. I don't see any rule of law out here, no order, no justice. God must not care. God must not be able to control this. I mean, they're questioning God. Absolutely. Looking at the pagans around them, they're getting ahead and we're over here, we're His people. I just, you know, that's not fair. That's the crowd. It's not fair. It's not right. It is. People still say the same thing today. That's right, brethren. So, lack of justice, and they didn't care for that. Verses 8 through 12, and I'm doing some skipping here. Verses 8 through 12. Again, the prophet says they're guilty of what? Robbing God. They say, well, how have we robbed Him? I don't see any proof of that. What was the proof that they were robbing God? They weren't paying their tithes. They were holding back on giving God what was due. Again, there's no indication in the text. I'm just saying perhaps out of greed or being stingy, whatever the reason was, they weren't paying their tithes. So what did the prophet say to do? Verse 10, bring the whole tithe. Whatever you're obligated to pay, bring it in and then see if God doesn't do what? Test me, verse 10. If I won't do what God says, I will. I'll give you more blessings than you can hold and deal with. I'll really pour it on you, but you're gonna have to tithe. That's what the law said. Absolutely. Absolutely so. So God challenged them. Test me. Try me. And see if I won't do as I've told you that I will. But you're going to have to meet me halfway on this. You're going to have to do what the law said. And as far as God was concerned, again, he's being robbed. So, make the application. There's no percent for us to give today, is there? What's the New Testament teaching regarding making contributions? It's free will offering. What amount? Liberally, that word is used. From the heart, and as God has prospered you. Yes, I know, but how much? Well, that's up to you. As you but what if you don't want to give a whole lot? What are you doing? You're robbing God. Now, let's call it what it is. And God knows your heart. God knows your heart. So, it's not hard to sit here and go through these verses and immediately make the New Testament application. God was concerned about their worship, their heart, their behavior. He's concerned about ours too. And we easily see ourselves in the similar situation. Also, verses 13 to 18. They said it was, here's another charge. It's vain to serve the Lord. It's useless to serve the Lord. There seems to be no good in doing it. How was that answered? Malachi 3, 13 to 18. They continue to see the prosperity of the wicked, but God blesses those who fear Him, doesn't He? Look at verse 16. Then those who feared the Lord spoke to one another, and the Lord gave attention and heard it. They weren't the ones making the charge who were saying, it doesn't make any sense to serve the Lord. But those who feared Him, they wouldn't make such a charge. Who does the Lord bless? He blesses those who fear Him. So if you want blessings, don't question God. I think that's the lesson that we see. So these are just generic or general rebukes or statements. So here's God's answer to these charges. Verse 17, chapter 2. Where is the God of justice? That was the charge that they leveled against God. Chapter 3, verse 14. It is vain to serve God. What profit is it that we have kept His charge? Those are pretty awesome charges leveled against God. Well, God has an answer. Chapter 4. What was the answer? He talked about the day of the Lord coming. The great day is coming. People will, yes, evil will be punished. Yeah, I'm going to send my messenger. Chapter 4, verses 4 through 6. And at the start of chapter 3, he mentions his messenger is going to come. The remnant was told that. Now, who's this referred to? It refers to John. How do we know that? That's what we say, but how do we know that? Jesus, talking about John, quotes what passage? Malachi. He quotes Malachi and applies it to John. So this day that's coming, would it be immediately coming to the remnant? Well, he was addressing their sins, but God had something bigger in mind, didn't he? Eventually, who was going to come? The messenger was going to come, and John's purpose was to do what? Prepare the way for the coming of the Son of God. And so this is a great messianic passage. We need to be appreciative of that and understand that's what the prophet was talking about. I know that we didn't cover everything in this class. Again, this wasn't an exhaustive study of Malachi. It's just to kind of give us a flavor of why God sent this prophet at this particular time to address these concerns that the remnant was having in the days of Nehemiah. So, having covered two classes on lesson 18, we have two classes left this coming Wednesday and next Sunday. And we'll do lesson 19. That's the last lesson of the material when we finish up the last three chapters of Nehemiah. So come with the lesson prepared, lesson 19 starting on Wednesday. Thank you for your good comments and your participation in class today.